Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Reclaimed. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. You can call me whatever you want.
Cool. And
Just call me great.
You're great. I love you.
Oh, thank you.
You're handsome. Your beard has many cookie crumbs in it.
It does not.
They look delicious from afar.
I haven't had cookies for... I can't remember the last time I ate a cookie.
Which makes it extra disturbing that you have so many cookie crumbs in your beard. This is a podcast where Whitney and I, we are professional film critics, but we haven't seen everything. And so every single week, we look at a different streaming service, and we each pick out a couple of movies from the past that Whitney and I, or one or the other, have somehow missed.
Yeah.
And then we put them on a poll for our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. And we let our patrons decide what we're going to watch. We pick a streaming service, we pick a category of some kind, and our patrons get to decide from the shortlist. This week, we are looking at comedies on HBO Max. And HBO Max actually has a pretty decent selection of comedies. We had a lot to choose from.
This was counter-programming for October.
Yeah.
Everybody's doing the horror movies.
Yeah.
We've seen a lot of horror movies. In fact, we did a Shudder poll once, and we had trouble finding things we hadn't seen before.
Yeah, Whitney and I are both really, really big horror nuts, and it doesn't really make a lot of sense to focus on horror too much in Critically Reclaimed because, frankly, between the two of us, there aren't a lot of major motion pictures we've missed. There's a few here and there.
There's a few. There's
we're not claiming we've seen everything, but there's most of the streaming services don't have a lot to challenge us right now.
The odds are higher when it comes to horror that we've seen the classics. So we decided to counter-program with some HBO Max comedy films.
Yeah, and the poll included films like 13 Going on 30. Yeah, the Jennifer Garner comedy everyone likes. Somehow one or both of us missed that.
Yeah, it was a slumber party classic for many years, and one of us never saw it.
The Clint Eastwood has an orangutan best friend movie, Every Which Way But Loose, which was a gigantic blockbuster. How did that happen? That was on the poll. But the winner of this week's poll is a film from Peter Bogdanovich, stars Barbara Streisand, Ryan O'Neill, features the cinematic debut of one of the greatest on-screen comedians of all time, Madeline Kahn.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how the hell this fell through the cracks, because, spoiler alert, this is one of the funniest movies I've seen in a very long time. Let's talk about What's Up, Doc?
This is San Francisco, the city chosen by one of the most brilliant and sensitive new generation of filmmakers, Peter Bogdanovich, for his maiden comedy effort, What's Up, Doc? Starring Barbara Streisand and Ryan O'Neill.
Where are we? I can't see.
Well, there's not much to see, actually. We're inside a Chinese dragon.
Any experienced observer of shooting techniques will quickly sense the utterly new and different atmosphere created on the Bogdanovich set. No more the crass showmanship and slapdash of the old Hollywood.
You think I play baseball with him?
Director Peter Bogdanovich loves movies.
Yeah, that's for sure.
He's one of those movie-loving directors.
Well, he started as a film critic.
He started as a critic. He wrote about movies. And a lot of his movies are either directly about movies, like The Last Picture Show, which is largely about a movie theater.
Yeah.
It's also a coming-of-age drama, but a lot of the drama centers around a movie theater in a small town.
Mm-hmm.
But he also likes kind of genre studies.
Yeah.
And film history as well.
Yeah, he likes to tell stories in genres that may not be currently popular. He's also told stories that take place in Hollywood past. He did a very interesting film called The Cat's Meow, which is about one of the biggest possible tabloidy type scandals in the golden age of Hollywood history, in which William Randolph Hearst might have murdered a guy. And got away with it.
Just maybe.
Yeah, everyone says he did. But he was able to just brush that under the rug.
The Cat's Meow is a very lackadaisical kind of movie. It's really loose and kind of laid back. Yeah. Eddie Izzard plays...
Chaplin.
Plays Charlie Chaplin. Completely out of character. Like, it's this weird movie version of Chaplin.
It's not really... It's an interesting choice. It's pretty good, but in any case, Bogdanovich's career is actually interesting because whereas a lot of filmmakers tend to get sort of shoehorned into one niche or another, Bogdanovich, for better or worse, I don't like all of his movies, he's really tried to play in a wide variety of storytelling styles. But one of his early successes was trying to bring back the screwball comedy, which is a very particular Hollywood genre of cinematic comedy in which everything is light, everything is wacky, there's tons of mistaken identities or misunderstandings, and everything is prone to either turn into a musical number or turn into some kind of wacky chase, or someone might get eaten by a leopard. Like, anything can happen.
There was a certain kind of, you might call it a bedroom farce, where there's a bunch of people in a big house together and they're all, like, running back and forth between bedrooms. There's a sort of broad comedy that was out of fashion, but there was a big push to bring it back in, like, the late 60s.
Yeah.
And the film that I'm thinking of is The Pink Panther, that really kind of pushed it back. Blake Edwards was a big proponent of these. I always hate to bring him up, but Woody Allen was also a big proponent of bringing this back.
Woody Allen and Mel Brooks. There was a lot of people trying to bring back these very broad, very silly comedies.
This push to allow the sort of Marx Brothers-esque and bringing a baby type movie back. Just that kind of farce.
If you want to see some of the classics of the original screwball wave of Hollywood comedies, amongst the films I would suggest would be My Man Godfrey, which is total classic. Bringing Up Baby is a delight. An underrated one, I feel, is I think it's Monkey Business with Cary Grant and
Fred Astaire.
Who is Fred Astaire's...
Ginger Rogers?
Ginger Rogers, thank you. Astaire Rogers. That's how I was trying to find the name. I couldn't remember Ginger Rogers' name for a second. I was like, well, she's in all the films with Fred Astaire. Surely if I say Fred Astaire, I'll remember Ginger Rogers. And then Ginger Rogers just was busy at that moment and didn't want to show up in my memory.
Ginger Rogers she's got better things to do than be remembered by you.
Yeah, I know. And she's doing them backwards and in heels. So who am I to... Anyway, I screwed up. But anyways, that's a very, very funny movie. These are very, very silly films. But they're also... In a way, they're also... A lot of them are commentary on how out of touch a lot of people are. Often the rich. The wealthy, the people who have no real problems, and how they are allowed to be kooky eccentrics who destroy everything.
Yeah, that's definitely the Marx Brothers mold. Another big influence on Peter Bogdanovich, specifically for this film, to steer it toward What's Up, Doc, is Bugs Bunny.
Yeah. The old Looney Tunes cartoons.
The old Looney Tunes cartoons. I've heard this parallel made by several critics, that Disney made... these very classical cartoons, classical music, whereas the Bugs Bunny cartoons were jazz. They were a little bit messier, but a lot more improv. They were a lot more just sort of exciting and earthy rather than sort of mannered and formal.
I don't really agree with that.
You watch like something like The Old Mill versus Duck Amuck. And I know those are like 20 years apart, but...
Those are 20 years apart, exactly. That's a good point. I feel like if you look at a lot of the early... Merry Melody Looney Tunes, and you look at some of the early era Mickey Mouse cartoons, they're playing in the same sandbox, I think. And so, I feel like what happened was Looney Tunes became far much more about conflict than the Disney shorts did after a while.
Well, like, it became about comedy, whereas the Disney shorts were a little bit more freewheeling and visually interesting, but they were rarely laugh out loud funny.
And I feel like a lot of that I feel like a lot of that comedy comes from conflict because there's people you can explode.
Yeah,
because there's a lot more you can do.
There's less dynamite in Bugs Bunny Mickey Mouse cartoons than in Bugs Bunny cartoons.
Significantly less. Mm. Yeah, and I think as a result of there being less conflict, there's often a little less madcap energy. But I feel like that's, for me, that's where I think the bigger distinction is, but we can agree to disagree, and there are other people who know more about it than we do. I haven't seen every single Disney cartoon, I haven't seen every single Looney Tunes cartoon, although I've tried. I'm a huge fan. And so is Peter Bogdanovich. So, What's Up, Doc? Stars Barbara Streisand as the Bugs Bunny character, basically. She is an instrument of chaos. She is very bright, but she's also kind of a grifter when we first meet her in the movie. She's perfectly willing to con and trick people in order to get what she wants, but she's effortlessly charming. She's very, very alluring. Hmm. She's desperately trying to seduce Ryan O'Neill.
And who can blame her? Because this is 1972 Ryan O'Neill.
This is prime O'Neill.
Well, it's also prime Streisand. So we got these two like young, attractive comedians, sort of at the height of their powers.
Yeah. Ryan O'Neill, who is already hot off of the film Love Story, which was a gigantic monster success.
It was huge.
I've actually never seen it.
Oh yeah.
But it's I know all about it.
Like it tries to be really like earnest, but it's super corny.
You ever see the sequel?
I have.
Isn't it good?
Oliver's Story is the title, because that's the name of his character, and Ally McGraw dies in the first one. Yeah. That's the premise of the movie,
that's like the selling point of the film. They're young and they're in love, but she's dying, and that's the drama.
I think it's Candace Bergen who he falls in love with in the sequel?
That sounds right, but I don't know. I haven't seen it.
Let me look up a place. But she's like... Yeah. Like far more interesting than he is.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, I'm so lovelorn and I'm boring. Oh, look, an actual interesting person. Can we have an affair? I don't know. I'm boring. Well, I'm not. that's kind of the premise.
If you don't know the film Love Story, if you've ever heard the expression "love means never having to say you're sorry," A, that's a stupid thing to say, and B. B, it's from Love Story.
Yeah.
In any case, Ryan O'Neill was a big star. Barbara Streisand already had an Academy Award. She's also a gigantic star, singer and actor alike. And we've got an amazing supporting cast here too. Again, Madeleine Kahn makes her cinematic debut.
Several actors who would, just 2 years later would be in Young Frankenstein and Blazing Saddles
and Paper Moon. So, some of them too.
Yeah. So we have not just Madeleine Kahn.
Mm-hmm.
Making her film debut, but we have Kenneth Mars.
Yes, Kenneth Mars, you might also remember from The Producers and Young Frankenstein, as you said. Let's see, who else have we got here?
Austin Pendleton.
The great Austin Pendleton, wonderful character actor. Mm. Austin Pendleton is in this. Randy Quaid, I've never seen Randy Quaid this young.
He only has one line in this.
He's got like two scenes and he gets to hit somebody. So it's Randy Quaid. but I've never seen him this young. He looks like a teenager. Like, it's weird to see him this young. M. Emmett Walsh has a small role in this movie.
I actually yelled that out loud. Because he shows up as a bailiff late in the movie and he's in profile, so you can't really tell who it is at first.
Yeah.
And I just said, "Hey, M. Emmett Walsh," like I'm on a TV special.
This is also one of those movies in the early 70s where apparently Sylvester Stallone was an extra, and there's a few of those.
Oh wow! Okay.
I couldn't make him out. Maybe he's not there. But he's in there somewhere. So anyway, great cast overall, and the plot is kind of hard to follow. So I'm going to give you the gist of it as best. I'm going to give you the general gist.
It's a broad farce. It starts off. We see the credits in a book, like we're looking through a storybook, and the title pages. This is the story of a mixed up. No, satchel.
This is the story of a bag, basically. So the idea is there is a suitcase. It's a plaid suitcase, basically.
Right.
And
there's three identical suitcases.
Four.
No, three.
No, there's four. So there's four people have identical suitcases. Ryan O'Neill has a suitcase that contains igneous rocks that he's using in his research. He is studying the tonality of rocks for music purposes.
He wants to reveal that Stone Age people invented music by hitting rocks together and they could actually create rudimentary musical tones.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a real thing.
No, there's a tendency in a lot of screwball comedies for when people are supposed to have a brilliant idea to just come up with this really silly idea or something that is blown way out of proportion. My favorite version of that is in the Palm Beach Story, where Joel McRae is an inventor and what he's trying to raise money for is to build his invention of he wants to cover all of New York City in a giant net, a steel net. And the idea is that planes could land on the net instead of taking up space for an airport, which is the stupidest idea I've ever heard in my life.
And I think even in the movie, they ask, how would they get down?
it's a lot of stupid, but in any case. There is a mysterious a political dissident who has stolen top secret government papers
from Russia.
And no, I think it's America, isn't it? He's trying to, like, you know.
Oh, right. They're American
papers. Initially, you think he might be like an American spy, but it turns out he's actually like he's actually spying on Americans. So he's got top secret documents in one of these cases. There's a wealthy socialite older lady who has a same suitcase, but it's full of valuable jewels. And then there's Barbara Streisand's bag, which just has, like, her underwear in it.
Oh, I didn't realize Barbara Streisand also had a bag.
Yeah, Barbara Streisand.
I thought she was bagless, which was why she was a grifter.
No. She's got a bag. But at the beginning of the movie, Barbara Streisand seems to be, she's hungry, and so she comes up with a scheme to go into a hotel, order room service for a room that doesn't have anyone in it, and then just say, leave it outside the door and take the food.
Not a bad grift.
No. Honestly, like, especially at the time when they probably didn't, like, have it computerized and, like, know who was in each room. Like,
and you can still do that to an extent. It's like, you go to a hotel, just charge it to my room.
Oh, yeah.
I'm surprised it doesn't happen more often. Surely there's ways to...
I'm sure there is, but they
prevent that from happening.
In any case, it's a pretty clever grift for any sort of normal situation. Staying at that hotel is Ryan O'Neill and his fiancée, Madeline Kahn. Madeline Kahn is... extremely pushy, but not in an evil way. Just her fiance is, today we would clearly say he's neurodivergent. He is definitely not responding to stimuli the way a typical person would. And I don't mean typical in a positive way, I just mean he's neurodivergent. In wacky comedies, these characters were just considered eccentrics, but nowadays we would probably look at someone like Cary Grant's character in Bringing Up Baby, and we would say to themselves, oh, okay, cool. So it's kind of fun to see, like, people who view the world differently and who respond to stimuli differently find each other. It's really sweet and romantic.
And there's a lot of... and this is sort of the birth of what would come to be known as the Manic Pixie Dream Girl, where there's sort of like...
I think was Catherine Hepburn and Bringing Up Baby. Carol Lombard and My Man Godfrey, I think, predates that.
I was going to say, Lubitsch probably invented it, because Lubitsch invented everything in comedy. this idea that there's sort of a straight-laced, buttoned-down, socially awkward, maybe kind of quiet, nerdy type of male who runs into a much more free-spirited young woman who finds him very attractive.
And gets him in tons of trouble.
Gets him in a lot of trouble, but in so doing, brings him out of his shell. And in the better ones, she also learns to sort of meet him at his level a little bit.
Yeah.
Rather than just sort of yanking him out of his comfort zone.
Exactly.
But the idea being that these neurotic men need to be pushed out of their comfort zone to sort of enjoy a lot more of
life.
Earth's earthier pleasures.
Yeah. She immediately zeroes in on Ryan O'Neill and decides, I am gonna fuck that. And
you get it because it's Ryan O'Neill, and Ryan O'Neill he looks like a superhero. He's super handsome. In fact,
even when he's playing a nerd, he's very attractive. And
there's a
very appealing
scene in this later on in this movie where he's struggling with his clothes. He's trying to get dressed for bed.
Oh yeah.
And he
manages to take off everything except his bow tie.
He has his glasses and his bow tie, but gets his shirt off. And I'm wondering if this predates Chippendales.
I don't know, but that definitely the first thought in your head when you watch that scene now is Chippendales.
Yeah.
Chippendales dancers wear that.
Yeah. Because Chippendales was founded in the 70s.
You look that up. I'll keep telling about the plot.
Chippendales didn't start until 79.
Okay, so maybe that was in there somewhere.
This. So maybe this is like the birth of that look, like the hunk in the bow tie.
Maybe it's direct, maybe it's indirect. Mm-hmm. Maybe that was just the style of the time.
You know who I learned was a Chippendales dancer recently?
Huh.
Robert Zadar.
I did hear that. Dancer. Yeah. That's cool.
B-movie legend Robert Zadar was a Chippendales dancer.
In any case, so she's decided she's going to boink Ryan O'Neill. There is a scheme.
But also bilk him.
Oh, yeah. She wants him to buy her things, but she gives that up. She gives up on that really fast, actually, when she realizes that it's kind of exploiting a naive child at that point. He's too easy a mark. She feels bad.
Their meet cute is in the gift shop of the hotel where most of the action takes place.
Yeah.
And she's in the gift shop. He's there. He, like, takes a rock because he's interested in rocks. He sees her and she goes up to the clerk and starts giving him stuff and saying, my husband will pay for all of this.
Yeah.
He's just looking for a bottle of aspirin for Eunice, played by Madeline Kahn, his actual fiance.
Yeah.
And yeah, Eunice is also a rather offensive cliche from like 1950s sitcoms, the kind of... The nagging wife, the harridan.
Yeah. Although, I will say this, and one thing I like about What's Up, Doc? Is though, although she is clearly nagging Ryan O'Neill, and clearly they're not meant to be together. If they get married, they're not going to have a particularly happy life. She's also not a bad person.
No.
They're
no,
just
no,
mismatched. They're just not... They don't belong together.
You understand that... you understand what their relationship is and who these kinds of people are, and yeah. You don't hate her.
No. In fact, she's actually the victim of so much shit in this movie.
Oh my god,
you
yeah.
Actually, you feel so bad for her, you want her to end well, and fortunately, things do work out for her. The reason she has a headache is Barbara Streisand, everywhere she walks, people get in car accidents because she like just doesn't pay attention to like walk signals or crosswalks or anything. And it leads to, at the beginning of the movie, a lot of situations in which it looks like Barbara Streisand nearly got killed.
Like the actual actress on the set of this movie.
Like, sometimes it's clearly a stunt double. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's clearly Barbara Streisand, and like, they just crashed a car 3 seconds after she walked by. And it's just like, Jesus, what are you trying to kill Barbara for?
They did it dangerous back in the day.
They sure did. And in fact, apparently this was one of, if not the first Hollywood movie to credit the stunt crew in the credits.
Well, good, because there's a lot of car stunts in this
there's
movie.
There's a ton. We'll talk about it later, but there's a ton. And it's worth remembering that until, I want to say it was because of Billy Barty in the Lord of the Rings animated movie, where he wasn't going to be credited for the acting performance, and he sued for it. But until the late 70s, early 80s, they did not include every single person who worked on a movie.
Yeah,
in the credits.
Yeah, you'll notice credits were a lot shorter back in the
day. Yeah, and then around 1980-ish, somewhere around there, they started including all of the credits. And I heard somewhere that's because of Billy Barty suing for more credit in the Lord of the Rings animated movie. I don't know how true that is. Barbara's getting a lot of people killed. Madeline Kahn hits her head in one of these car accidents, and now she needs an aspirin. It all leads to Barbara following Ryan O'Neill around, talking about how he's her husband, and Madeline Kahn, of course, gets the wrong idea. And now they're on the outs. They are in town, Ryan O'Neill and Madeline Kahn, to try to get a grant for their research. And it's between them and one other asshole played by Kenneth Mars. And so there's a big sort of gala banquet.
And Kenneth Mars is playing sort of like the funny foreign guy. Another kind of offensive stereotype. But, you know, that was sort of Kenneth Mars' stock and trade.
Yeah, at least he's playing a white foreign guy.
Yeah,
at least there's that.
I think his character's Dutch, if I recall.
I don't remember. I honestly think he's just one of those things where he's from everywhere. So they're at a banquet, and Barbara Streisand decides to impersonate Ryan O'Neill's fiance at the banquet and tell everyone that she's his fiance and try to get him that grant. Meanwhile, Madeline Kahn, whose name tag has been taken by Barbara Streisand, is trying to get in, and it all leads to a big hullabaloo.
It leads to a big betrayal because Barbara Streisand is so charming, and because she's posing as his wife and is with him, all of the people who would give him the grant money are charmed by her.
Yeah, she's the one who's getting the grant money here, not
because,
him.
Yeah. Because of her, she's going to get the grant money. So when Madeline Kahn charges into that that diner, Ryan O'Neill looks up at his own fiancée and says, "I don't know her," in this like rare moment of betrayal, of making his own decisions.
Yeah. And I feel like it's interesting because it actually is kind of in character, because she has clearly said, in maybe not using these words, but I know in certain terms it was implied that she wants him to do whatever he needs to do to get that grant money. So betraying her is also doing what she told him to do. So it kind of fits. But in any case, their relationship is probably already wrecked. He goes back to his hotel room, and he just wants to die. He's over, he's done, and sure enough, Barbara Streisand is taking a bath in his hotel room. And now he can't get rid of her, and Madeline Kahn is jumping in, and he's trying to throw Barbara Streisand out the window, but she's, like, afraid of heights.
Meanwhile, the spy is already outside of the window, so there's,
Somebody
is already out on the ledge.
All of the suitcases have already managed to be, like, mixed up by now. Oh. So everyone's trying to break into every single hotel room. Now things are on fire. And it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And by God, is it just comedy perfection. The timing, the escalation, the way things that you knew were going to happen in a way you did not expect. Just sheer brilliance. It's absolutely stunning. We skipped over the funniest bit in the movie for me. There's a bit where, okay, so the maitre d', or whatever, the concierge at the hotel, is in cahoots with the hotel detective, which is a thing they have. They had detectives whose whole job was to be a private detective for the hotel.
I only knew about hotel detectives because of a song by They Might Be Giants.
Yeah, that's an actual...
She was a hotel detective.
That's an actual thing. You could just be a detective who works for the hotel. You know, keeping things on the hush-hush, investigating crimes without getting the police involved, that kind of thing. Fascinating job. The concierge is in cahoots with the hotel detective to steal the old lady's diamonds. And the problem is that he's misplaced the satchel, so the concierge has to, go upstairs and, switch some things around in order to get the diamonds, or so he thinks. And he tells the hotel detective to stall her. And the guy's like, how am I supposed to do that? And the concierge says, use your charm. And then he's like, okay, charm. Charm. And he's like walking up to her just saying charm, psyching himself up. Charm. And then he violently trips her. He just trips her right there in the lobby. And then later on, we cut to her getting off of the elevator and her getting off and him getting off after her, still trying to violently trip her.
It's good.
It sets you up. Good, you think you know what the joke is going to be. He's going to try to be charming and he's not. And then he just trips her.
Here's the great thing about What's Up, Doc, and the way it kind of differs from a lot of modern comedies are, I think, a little self-aware. They know, and this is a self-aware comedy as well. This is a farce that is a throwback. It's something that wasn't common at the time.
A lot of spoofs to movies that people might not instantly recognize anymore nowadays. Like, the big car chase at the end is a big spoof of the movie Bullet. Yeah, which is famous, but probably not instantly recognizable to people anymore, for the most part.
Yeah, it's a... Which both of those movies take place in San Francisco, if I recall.
Yeah.
I feel like you see a sort of a well crafted comedy these days, an actual scripted one, when they rarely come along.
Yeah.
And something like Game Night, and I think there is a little bit of a self awareness to it. You know, they understand that they're doing something a little bit farcical. Here, they understand that, but Peter Bogdanovich makes it seem like he's improvising, like it's really breezy, like he's kind of discovering this chaos as it happens, rather than constructing a scene in his head.
Which the Coen brothers tend, when they do something like this, the Coen brothers tend to make it feel like God is interfering with people's lives, and they're pressed up against the inevitable. Mm-hmm. Whereas a lot of the better early screwball comedies, and when the Coen brothers do it, by the way, they do it great. They have their own vibe. A lot of the early screwball comedies just feels like everyone is behaving in character. As kooky as that is, and this is just what naturally would have happened. It doesn't feel contrived, even though it's obviously incredibly contrived. And at his best, Bogdanovich is capable of capturing that.
Yeah, he did it one other time too, in the 90s.
Oh, with Noises Off?
With Noises Off.
That's a very funny movie.
Noises Off is great, by the way. Like, it's, I think it's like sort of the sequel to What's Up, Doc, in a lot, now that I've seen both of them.
It's a great double feature.
Yeah, like the both of them are in a similar vein.
And he would eventually try to recapture... What's Up, Doc was a monster success. It was the third highest grossing film of the year. It came out behind only The Godfather and I think The Poseidon Adventure.
Wow.
Which is...
And those were both runaways.
Those were gigantic successfuls. And by the way, The Godfather was the number one movie of the year. Remember when we had movies that were like just dramas that would be the number one movie of the year?
It happened a couple of years ago with American Sniper.
That's true. That's pretty rare.
But yeah, that was an oddity. It's mostly been superheroes and Star Wars for the last decade.
It's been a while, or at least pre-existing IP like Jurassic Park
Harry Potter.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Catching Hunger Games.
Hunger Games. There you go. That kind of thing. But where was I going with this? I got distracted, but it was a monster success. Everyone was happy. And it was a good... Oh, he also tried to recreate this success in the late 70s with a film that was basically trying to be this, except more of a musical, called At Long Last Love.
Oh, no.
Which is...
Oh, no.
legitimately a bad movie. Like, it's not entirely without charm because, like, the actors... It's got a good cast.
Uh-huh.
It's got Burt Reynolds, Madeline Kahn, Candice Bergen. Who's the other Candice Bergen from Moonlighting?
the other Candice Bergen?
Yeah, you know, from Moonlighting.
Oh, who was in? I never saw Moonlighting.
You never saw Moonlighting? The show Moonlighting?
No. Well, I think he was a little too young for Moonlighting.
Cybill Shepherd.
Oh, so, okay. The Civil other Shepherd. Kid is for his Civil Shepherd.
To my mind, yes. They're the same person.
I wasn't sure you were talking about. Okay.
So it's got Civil Shepherd. It's got Eileen Brennan. Mm. It's a good cast. But it's... What's Up, Doc? Is wound so tight. It actually is, even though it feels breezy, it actually is very carefully calibrated. And At Long Last Love feels very loosey-goosey to the point where it's just slow. It's just really slow.
It's slow moving, and it was one of those things where it's a musical. Burt Reynolds can't sing
at all.
Not that way. And no. Yeah, and they let the actors sing. I'm not sure if they. I don't think they sang on set.
No, they did.
They were recorded live. Okay.
Yeah. Some of them were better at that than others. They went for the old fashioned movie musical motif where the songs don't have to have anything to do with anything, mm-hmm. which can be fine if they're entertaining enough and not getting in the way. Except they're not entertaining enough and they get in the way. I couldn't even tell you how this movie ended if I put a gun to my head. I've seen this movie twice. And it's damn bad. Anyway, so he couldn't capture that lightning in a bottle every single time. But What's Up, Doc is a wonder.
We showed At Long Last Love at the New Beverly.
Oh, wow.
Can you guess what the double feature was? Like, what would you pair? Give
me a hint. Was it classic Hollywood?
No, newer film.
Newer film. Yeah. So they paired it with Xanadu.
Newer than that.
Newer than that.
Yeah. Very recent film.
God, was it La La Land?
It was La La Land.
Oh, that's a form of commentary.
I like to think that there was a little bit of actual commentary going on at the New Beverly programming level.
Because one of the things that like fans of like old school musicals, one of the things a lot of people, not everyone, but a lot of people were critical about for La La Land was that Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone are very charming performers. They're not singers. And they are definitely not dancers.
No,
like they learned the choreography.
They learned steps, but you can tell that they're not like professional dancers.
And when you compare the musical numbers in La La Land to the musical numbers in even a not very well regarded old musical, they do not hold up at all. And I've heard some people say like, yeah, but it's okay because they're not supposed to be that good. It's a movie. They're supposed to be that good. They're supposed to be as good as they can be.
So we're coming here to watch a musical about people who can't sing and dance very well.
Yeah. Also, the whole idea that, like, oh, they're not supposed to be that good because this is all in their own head. These are people who think very highly of themselves.
If it's all in their own head, they
would
be
amazing. Yeah, exactly. It does not track at all. La La Land is another movie that I think just got built up too much. It's cute enough, but, like, everyone treated it like the second coming of something. Yeah. And it's not. It's just barely okay. There's a couple of good bits. The ending's good. That kind of thing. Anyway, we're off track. What's Up, Doc? Continues apace. More suitcases go to different hands. There's an incredible sequence.
I don't want to describe what happens because, a lot happens.
It's too confusing.
A lot happens very rapidly.
I want to get to a couple of key sequences so that we've talked about them because they're really great sequences. The first one is actually one where the story slows down. Mm-hmm. And Ryan O'Neill, he's actually been kicked out of the hotel and he's been told he has to leave, but he accidentally winds up on the roof. And I guess they're like building like a rooftop restaurant or cafe. So there's construction stuff there and there's a piano. And he starts tinkling on the piano. And wouldn't you know, Barbra Streisand just happens to be there. Mm-hmm. And she serenades him. And she successfully seduces him. He hasn't even broken up with Madeline Kahn yet. And they have sexy sex.
Oh, yeah.
You know, off camera, but, you know, afterwards they're like naked and rolling around in a sheet. I'm just going to say it right now. I don't think people talk about it enough. Barbra Streisand was incredibly alluring.
Oh, definitely.
In this movie. And this movie in particular, she is very sensual. And it's the sort of thing where, like, oftentimes the sort of the wacky characters in these kind of screwball comedies, they're attractive, but they're not necessarily seen as, like, sexual, because there's often a chance people don't want them to seem predatory.
Well, there's this... because a lot of these movies are made by men, and the way a funny female character is treated is usually kept very separate from their sexuality.
Yeah.
There's two types of women, the funny one and the sexy one, because that's the way close-minded men in Hollywood think.
Mm-hmm.
So it was rare that you found a female character that was
both.
Just sort of naturally both.
Yeah.
And that's what Barbra Streisand is here. And I'm not trying to be lascivious and, you know, comment on, you know, an actor's looks, but
I think to be attracted to her.
That she is an attractive character is key to the movie.
This movie, I actually appreciate this. This movie leers at Ryan O'Neill the same way, actually more so even, than it leers at Barbra Streisand.
Yeah.
This movie wants
equal
you...
Equal opportunity leering.
This movie wants everyone in the audience to be attracted to one or both of them.
Yeah.
So that you have a sort of, not just an emotional investment, but almost like a physical investment in these two hooking up. So, and I think that's a very effective way to handle it, because I think too many movies pick just one or the other and assume the audiences all have one interest. And no, What's Up Doc is very equal opportunity in that regard. Everyone who is supposed to be sexy is treated in a sexy way, even though they're all goofy. And that's great. It all culminates with everyone running after each other, and they're all... It ends with Ryan O'Neill and Barbra Streisand have taken all of the bags, and they've put them in, like, a bicycle with a very large, like, cart in the front for, like, delivering groceries. And it ends with an incredibly long car chase. Like, a shockingly long car. Like, Fast and the Furious movies would say, this is a long car chase. You've pushed this one a lot.
It's this movie's 92 minutes, and it's the last, like, 20 minutes of the film.
Yeah,
it's the car chase.
It's a lot. But none of it's faked, because it's the 70s, and that wasn't possible. All of it is very funny, which is hard to do when you're doing things like elaborate car stunts and breaking shit.
Yeah, like car chases are often sold as being very funny,
mm-hmm.
but
very rarely are.
Very rarely are. There's,
I think it's Blues Brothers did it a couple of times in the Blues Brothers. Actually, that movie's a marvel when it comes to its car chases. Mad World. Does it very, very well. The Italian Job, the ending of Italian Job, has a lot of funny bits in it.
And you have to do something kind of funny with it. I remember there was a cute car chase gag in 21 Jump Street. Where there's a big freeway chase, and they're crashing into cars, and they crash into a gasoline truck, and nothing happens. And they crash into liquid nitrogen or something else really dangerous, and then they crash into a chicken truck, and the chicken truck explodes.
Yeah.
Like, the chickens themselves explode. That's a, you know, a fun subversion of action movie tropes.
They had another good one in 21 Jump Street where they've already, like, broken so much stuff that Ice Cube tells them that they're out of money. Like, we don't have unlimited funding for this undercover op. You can't do anything else now. We're out of money. So when there's a car chase that shows them, like, driving into a building and then screaming about all the expensive stuff that they're breaking.
That's right.
And then just driving out.
A static shot of the exterior of the building.
That's genius.
Oh.
And I think, don't they even drive past it? And isn't it even, like, the Benny Hill Memorial Building or something?
Yeah, it was the Bennett Hill Memorial. Yeah, it's a little, cute little gag there.
Great little gag. The gags in What's Up, Doc? Are stunners.
The pane of glass gag pays off beautifully, I'm not going to describe the pane of glass
I will say this, you know the gag, and you've seen it in all kinds of movies and cartoons and things, where there's a car chase, or someone's driving really, really fast, and you just see two poor construction workers walking across the street with a giant pane of glass. This pane of glass literally has, like, an X in it, so you know where the car is supposed to drive through.
Well, that's
and you
something know where actually they do in being a glazier.
I know, I'm just saying. So you see where it's there, and so you're waiting for it to happen, and the trick is, if you're doing the gag, don't let it happen the usual way. My favorite version of this before I saw What's Up, Doc was in Wayne's World 2,
where... Yeah. Wayne and Garth are walking through like an area, like an alley where they're clearly going to have a car chase later, because he asks, what are you guys doing? Well, it's their job to carry that pane of glass back and forth all day.
Well, what's your job? It's my job to make sure we always have plenty of watermelons.
Yeah, I push this fruit cart back and forth all day, like things people crash into.
And they're just like,
chases.
Oh, this is interesting. I wonder if this will be important later. And then later on, there's a big car chase, and he smashes through the glass, and they break all the watermelons. And all those construction guys who normally would be like, nuts. They're just like, well, our job is done.
A job well done, yeah. waiting for the car chase to come through.
The way that they milk the pane of glass gag in What's Up, Doc, study this in school. Study this. Say that comedy cannot be explained. That is not true. I have taken college classes in comedy. Comedy cannot be explained without making it less funny, because you're treating it like some kind of math equation. But the idea of setting things up and then taking away the payoff and then delivering the payoff in a different way, there is a kind of chemistry to that that you can teach. And that gag alone is, you could spend an entire day on that in college and not get all of the details right. They just fucking nailed it. Astounding. There's a lot of gags because it's San Francisco. There's a lot of gags about driving cars down very, very steep roads, including one road that's got like 8 hairpin turns on it. It's like the twistiest road in the world. There's one where they
drive down a tourist attraction.
I forget the name of it. They drive down this very famous like set of like long steps. And apparently they permanently damaged those steps.
Oh, no.
And as a result, San Francisco now requires anyone who asks for a shooting permit in San Francisco to be extremely detailed about what you're going to film.
Nah.
Because they were not happy about that shit.
Have you ever been to San Francisco?
Yeah.
Downtown San Francisco?
I've been a bunch of times, yeah.
It's incredibly hilly.
Oh, yeah.
It's incredibly difficult to get around.
You will get cardio if you live in San Francisco. Oh, yeah. Like, yeah, oh, yeah. My God.
Your calves are going to be bigger than your head. And it is not conducive to car chases.
No, it's uniquely unconducive to car chases, which is why it's perfect for car chases.
I suppose so, but...
It's where you want to do it because it's crazy. There's one of my favorite video games ever was called San Francisco Rush. And it's a car chase through the streets of San Francisco, and everything is a ramp. So you can constantly fly your cars off of shit. But anyway, it's incredible that they did all of this and that they did it. I think I had like 19 days to shoot it, which when you see them, how much they got does not feel like a lot. Like it actually is really quite incredible. Stuntmen were hurt in the making of this. And you can
they did it dangerous.
There's a couple of people, there's a couple of falls that look like, oh God, that at least tweaked that guy's back. That's not good.
One guy got
knocked unconscious by hitting his head on like an awning during like the final bit of the car chase where he's like, flying through like some tents and stuff, and that sucks.
If you're a stunt person and you know you're putting your life in danger for entertainment, and it's a dangerous, difficult job,
very much so.
And something wrong happens, and you do get injured, which does happen. It's safe; you can take precautions, but you're still doing a dangerous thing.
You're minimizing the risk, but on a long enough timeline, there's a greater potential for risks or something bad to happen eventually.
Would you want the take where you got injured to be in the final cut just to show off that, yes, I got injured and at least my injury lent to the film? Or would you want that to be like, would you want that to be hidden away and you want like the actual more professional shot to be left in the movie because the injury is a little bit less responsible?
Well, I think there's a couple of different takes on that. And of course, I think any stunt person is allowed to have their own take on that. They're the ones who did it. They're the ones who got hurt. I think they should definitely be in on that decision. I think if you can tell the person got hurt, you don't put it in the movie because it hurts the movie, especially if it's a comedy. Like, the whole point is it's a comedy. People don't seriously get hurt. You know, it's always pretty light and frivolous. But if we saw just like at the end of this, like someone was like missing a leg or something.
Oh, God.
No, like, it depends on how vividly the injury is captured on camera as well. I know like people like who did like Mad Max stunts who got injured, who wanted them in the film because they were just that awesome. But, and of course, and it fortunately doesn't happen often, but it does happen. Stunt people have died making movies. Never use that footage. Don't you ever use that footage. That's incredibly irresponsible.
That's the kind of stuff an old friend of ours, the late John Schwartz, who is the founder of Faces of Death.
Major cult phenomenon, Faces of Death.
Look up Faces of Death. Yeah, if you were an incredibly unhappy goth in the 80s, you knew about this stuff. He would like sort of compile like death and injury footage just in a cassette. So a lot of it was staged. Some of it wasn't.
Yeah,
and like some of it was like actual footage of animals being hurt. And you know, if you were into that kind of shock, that's what those were for.
Yeah, they were basically Faces of Death existed for like
it's like dares. People,
I dare you to see Faces of Death. That's why that existed. It was I dare you to confront death. And that was basically the philosophy behind it. You can argue it's irresponsible, but it sure was a thing.
Five, six volumes of Faces of Death.
At least there are four. I don't know how many. But yeah, stuff.
And we had John Schwartz on a podcast.
He was a nice man.
He and his wife, Joan, were actually very, like, he's a bit gloomy, but he's a pleasant fellow.
Alas, he passed away.
A pleasant fellow.
Yeah, but no, they were very, very nice to us. They were very, very nice people. I haven't seen Joan in a long time, but she's always just been such a bright personality, and what a nice human being.
But that's all a tangent on, you know, actual danger on film, which was really common, like, more commoner in more common, or listen to me, in the 1970s, I think a lot of safety precautions have been added over the years to stunt work so that it's as safe as you can get while still doing something incredibly dangerous.
Yeah. What's Up, Doc? It ends happily because it's a comedy. Mm.
It ends in a big courtroom sequence where all of the characters are finally gathered in one place.
Everyone has to try to explain the plot, and it's impossible. Yeah. And then it ends with
where we see Emmett Walsh, and the judge is played by the actor who played the priest in Blazing Saddles.
Yeah, there's a really really funny bit towards the end where you've often seen the thing where like, oh no, if only I'd got that $20,000 grant money. Well, I guess my career is over. But dang it. Oh, I saved the life of this one person and they're going to give me the $20,000. There's a joke where they do that. Mm. And Ryan O'Neal has lost the grant money and everything. Mm. And his whole life is ruined. And then like the old lady is like, oh, well, the reward for the jewels was $20,000. Mm. Which I used to pay all the things you broke in San Francisco. There's $50 left. Enjoy.
Yeah.
That's a great gag. That's a brilliant gag. That is such a meta gag.
So they do get a reward.
It's just $50.
That's really great.
It's really great. I'm not going to ruin every single thing that happens at the end of the movie, but that's a brilliant gag and it deserves a lot of credit. That's a brilliant... Here's everything is. And now it's taken away.
This movie is... just so brilliant. Yeah. There's not a gag that lands wrong. It does bandy about a few stereotypes, but they're not so offensive that you'll be taken out of the movie.
Nothing's hateful, and nothing is lingered on very long if it's in poor taste.
The Harridan character is actually played with enough sensitivity that you actually sympathize with the Madeline Kahn character
a lot. At first you think she's going to be the Madeline Kahn character from Young Frankenstein, where she's just so cruel to Gene Wilder, you don't like her. But you realize is that, no, she's just kind of overbearing and they're mismatched.
Yeah.
Like, he can't stand up for himself. And as a result, she's allowed to be overbearing. And it's just not a healthy relationship. And yeah, they should break up. Mm. That's fine. That's not her being a terrible person. That's just her not gelling well with her partner. And so the movie takes pity on her after a while and actually, like, starts giving her what she needs. And it's really nice, actually. I like that a lot. A staggering number of jokes in this movie, and a staggering number of them land really, really well. I think, like, the worst joke in this movie is still kind of funny, which is really impressive.
Well, and it's one of those movies where it can make a dumb joke, but it's kind of aware that it's making a dumb joke, so you laugh anyway.
Yeah. There was, what was I just watching? I was watching the Muppets Haunted Mansion. Mm. And when Gonzo and Pepe the Prawn walk up to the Haunted Mansion, and they're greeted by... the host, played by Will Arnett, and there's a brief introduction, and then he says something to the effect of "Walk this way,"
and they walk in the same physical fashion he does. Yes.
They don't.
Oh, they don't. Okay.
No, you don't resist that joke. You have to do that joke every single time. It's funny because we keep doing that joke. You don't miss an opportunity for humor, even if the humor is kind of lazy. That's actually one of the secrets to a lot of great spoof comedy, whether it's Mel Brooks or Airplane or Top Secret, is for every genius joke, there's a lot of jokes that we're just not going to let the opportunity to do this joke pass us by. Mm. We're going to do the joke. It may be funny, it may not be funny, but we're not going to miss an opportunity. What's Up, Doc doesn't miss an opportunity for a joke.
Yeah.
Never. Some of them are funnier than others, but they're all funny, and that is astounding. This is... one of the best comedies I've ever seen. Mm. Maybe not number one, but it's one of the best. And I am mad at everyone who didn't shake me by the lapels I'm not wearing and say, "See, What's Up, Doc?" And I want to give credit, all the credit in the fucking world, to Alonzo Duralde, who was the one person doing it. The one person who was still...
carrying the torch for What's Up, Doc.
He's been telling me to see What's Up, Doc. He's been telling me to see What's Up, Doc. Alonzo Duralde, incredible film critic for The Wrap, co-host of the Linoleum Knife podcast. Please listen to it. It's a great podcast. We've had him on the show several times. He's great. He has wonderful taste. And he was right and I was wrong. I mean, I wasn't wrong. I wasn't, like, resisting it. I should have made the time
to
see this movie sooner.
If Alonzo's listening... I just want to let him know, I'm going to get to Two for the Road, okay?
Oh, God!
That's like his favorite movies. Yeah. He talks about it a lot.
I haven't seen
Two for the Road.
Okay.
That's a failing on me.
Okay.
That is a serious flaw in my character, and I apologize
okay.
to the movie and to Alonso Duralde for not having seen it yet.
Yeah, it's a really good film.
I'm not resisting it. I simply haven't gotten to it yet.
Sometimes it's hard to make the time for these things, but sometimes, you know, here's the deal. We're all critics, and we all want to encourage people. If we see something that we see as wonderful or that has great value, we want to encourage people to see it. They're under no obligation to.
Yeah,
but we're not doing it because I don't know. I don't make any money if you see What's Up, Doc. Like, it's not that I get nothing from it except the satisfaction that you've seen a good movie.
Yeah.
So we're trying to do favors here. We're trying to just make your life a little better by guiding you to a great movie. So don't make the mistake that I made. See What's Up, Doc. If you haven't already, and a lot of people have, this won our poll on a landslide. So we're clearly behind the curve on this one. If you haven't seen What's Up, Doc, we've ruined some of the jokes, not all of the jokes, and definitely the way they play out is funnier than we described them. See this movie. It's on HBO Max. It's very, very funny. I'm so glad we did it. Next time on Critically Reclaimed, we are heading over back to Disney Plus, because it turns out one of us...
Is it you or is it me?
One of us hasn't seen a lot of the bigger Disney classics. Maybe not a lot, but more than you might think. So we're going to focus on some of the bigger Disney animated movies that are available on Disney Plus, and the options in the poll are thus. And actually, a bit of a warning, Whitney is going out of town for a few days. There is a decent chance this episode might be, the next episode of Critically Reclaimed might be a little delayed, depending on how that works.
For that, I apologize.
No, and we might be able to get it done in time, but if it's delayed, that's going to be what happens. But we'll put the poll up anyway. The poll, your options are Bambi, the feel-good film about a deer and his mom.
And nothing bad happens at all.
Lady and the Tramp, the feel-good film about a lady and a tramp. And
It's about dogs
who fall in love and eat pasta.
I know they remade it, too.
They did. It wasn't particularly good. It was fine, but it wasn't particularly good. Let's see. And then The Lion King. The original Lion King. The animated Lion King. And I just want to say something right now. If you go to Disney Plus and you just look up movies and you look up animated, they will show you the 1990s Lion King, but not the 2010s
Lion King. Not the John Favreau Lion King, which is also animated.
Which is also animated! What is the matter with you? It's animated. It's CG animated.
I actually wanted to see like how, because that is like photorealistic animation.
It is.
It's really advanced
it's
looking.
Very it's very impressive it's an being impressive photorealistic.
Tech exercise. It's a crappy movie, I think.
It is. I agree.
But I was looking around like how much of this, like, did they use actual like film physical backgrounds and animate characters into it, like in that movie Dinosaur.
Yeah.
No, evidently there was a single shot right at the beginning.
Very first
that
shot.
That was
of
a
the
live
movie.
Action shot, and everything else is completely fabricated in computers.
And it looks great. And they did that for The Lion King as well. It looks great. I mean, there's more like actual like people interacting because there's a real human child in that movie. But those are all, the all those jungles are CGI.
Jungle Book.
What did I say?
You said Lion King again. But anyway.
In The Jungle Book.
The Jungle Book, yeah.
The Jon Favreau's Jungle Book, which is a better movie than his Lion King. You know, there's more human characters and stuff, but all of the jungle stuff is CG. It's incredible. It's very realistic. I'm impressed. Doesn't mean he told the story well. But in any case, the original 1990s 2D animated Lion King is on our list. Also on our list, Hercules. Who put the Glad in Gladiator? This film. so we will watch and review whichever one our patrons vote for over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. By the time this episode goes live, the poll should be available, and it's usually up for about 2 or 3 days. Yeah. You were saying?
Hercules has a very, very passionate cult of defenders.
It does.
And they were all born in the year 1981. So
it's like, a film that, like, it was one of the last films of the so-called Disney Renaissance. And it was, the movies were starting to dwindle a little bit in quality. Like, they're still pretty good.
The film that came immediately, the animated feature that Disney made immediately prior to Hercules was The Hunchback of Notre Dame, which was not the hit they wanted it to be.
No.
Because they were, Beauty and the Beast was a big hit on Broadway, so they were making a Broadway-ready film. So that feels very stagey.
Although they ended up putting on a very successful stage production of Hunchback. That was actually, like, more popular than the movie. The Hunchback. Oh, the other thing with Hunchback, though, is they really, much like Pocahontas, they really had to change the source material in order to make it Disney.
They have to make it like the studio aesthetic. They can't do something, you know, good or accurate.
When The Hunchback of Notre Dame is actually being a decent adaptation of the novel, that movie is great.
Yeah,
but when it's not, it's a fucking lie.
I do love the music.
It's really good.
But yeah, who wants like Quasimodo plushies? That's not pushing the merch.
It's a weird choice. Yeah.
So that one kind of was the first crack, and after that, it was a little bit of a downward slide.
Yeah, and there were movies that were mostly very good or had very, very good qualities, but they very few of them ever popped the way that The Little Mermaid or Lion King did.
Or Aladdin, Lion King. Yeah, those were the.
But Hercules is the one that probably like hung on the longest, and now it's considered by a lot of people to be one of the greats. Mm-hmm. And I've never, usually we don't say which one's which, but I've actually never seen all of Hercules.
Okay.
I've seen like half of it, but I never finished it. So this is one that I would finally sit down and watch all of Hercules if it wins the poll. But in any case, that poll is up at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, where we have a lot of other exclusive shows. If you haven't already signed up, we'd love to have you over there. We have shows dedicated to every single episode of Star Trek, every single episode of the 1960s Batman, every single film ever nominated for Best Picture, commentary tracks, and so forth.
And so much more.
And thank you to every single one of our patrons, without whom, A, we would never have seen What's Up Doc. Yeah. Well, not this week, anyway. B, without whom none of our shows would exist. Mm. So thank you so much to everyone. If you want to write in, you want to talk to us about What's Up Doc or anything else we discuss in the show or anything else you want to talk about, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email in an upcoming episode of our show, We've Got Mail. If you prefer to send us physical mail, some people do, and it's really nice to get. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Right into the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
We are also on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibiani.
I am at Whitney Seibold.
If you're interested in stocking up on stocking stuffers or maybe some fun stuff for the Halloween season, head on over to Salt Cat Soap. It's an Etsy store run by me and my partner, M. Lapis da Silva. We make and sell awesomely designed soaps. Mm. They smell really, really great. Some of them are very high concept. We have a glow-in-the-dark ghost soap, and we're in the process of making a whole bunch more of those because we cannot keep those in stock. So if you missed your chance, more are coming. Mm-hmm. And you can be on top of that release by following us on Twitter and or Instagram and or Facebook at Salt Cat Soap. But we also have pumpkins, we have Christmas ornament decorations, we have our Christmas ornament soaps. We have a lot of stuff for the holidays that are for this holiday and upcoming holidays as well, and we'll be releasing even more stuff throughout the season. So thank you everybody who's already bought some soap. We really appreciate it. Thank you so much for the very, very awesome reviews.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess that's it for Critically Reclaimed. We don't have a way to end this podcast, so instead we'll...